Hello and welcome back to Cruising Through History. It's been a month since we've been on the mic, and I'm sure, yeah, it's a long time. I'm sure Scott has finally been able to actually read more things in that time period, but, you know, we're back. We're going to go back through some history. For those of you who are new to the show, my name is Xander, and I am sitting here with Scott Cruz, and Scott is going to guide us through some history. So, Scott, where are we cruising through today?
Well, today, Xander, I'm going to talk about the John Franklin expedition to get through the Northwest Passage in the 19th century, 1845. But it's come down to history as the sort of the Franklin's Lost Expedition.
Okay.
Because it set out with 129 men. All of them died.
All 129?
Yes, they did.
Like, were they, when you say died, were they found or they just disappear
no,
off the face of
No, most of them disappeared.
Okay.
The reason this one gets a lot of attention, I believe, is because there had been sort of a background to this. Is in the early 19th century, the British Admiralty, after the Napoleonic Wars, they had a lot of officers who were like on half pay and stuff. So one of the ideas they came up with, a man named John Barrow said, hey, we should send some of these guys out exploring. And one of these things was this fabled Northwest Passage.
Yeah, and where is this Northwest Passage?
Well, it was through the Canadian Arctic. So if you go, most of the routes they took would sort of like go up to Greenland, turn left, it is left, and go through like Baffin, there's like Baffin Island, Baffin Bay, and I know it sounds like Baffin, but Baffin Bay. And then you would go into, and the problem was though, if you look at the geography of that area, there's all these little islands. So not only did you have to go through all the islands, it was the ice that was the problem. And a lot of times they would turn in, they would make a wrong turn, go into Hudson Bay, and they would think that was the Northwest Passage because it's such a huge body of water. But of course, eventually they would run into land and realize it was a bay and they'd have to turn around and come out. And it was the ice that, and most of the, most of the activity for King for John Franklin was in a place called King William Island, which is in the Canadian territory of, I hope I say this right, Nunavut, which is, that's the current name of, it's still up there. It hasn't moved, I guess, at all. So it became all the rage to try to find this thing. Because what the thinking was, if we can find a route through the Arctic, that's an easier route to get to, like, you know, the riches of China or to get to Russia.
So instead of the idea, so it's not, this Northwest Passage is more like a legend thing than, you know, an established passage at this time.
Right.
And they think the thought is that it's better than a ship route to try to do it this way.
Well, it would be a ship route, but what if you wanted to sail to China, let's say, for trade, you had to go through, you know, around Africa into the Indian,
and then
that,
yep.
Or you could go the other way, but you still had to sort of go around the globe.
Yeah, but then how they go instead? They go through Russia.
They thought if they went this way, it would be easier to get through. And in the first expedition was in 1818. William Perry and John Ross had done it. Ironically, this was Franklin's fourth expedition. Because he went a year after that first one in 1819. In fact, Franklin did have some notoriety from it because he was called the man who ate his boots. Because in that, and there's actually a book called on this topic. I can't remember the author, but the book is called The Man Who Ate His Boots, and it's about the history of the search for the Northwest Passage.
Isn't that a saying? Like that, you know, you eat your boots or something
I
like
think
that?
Usually it's, I'm going to eat my hat. I think that's the saying that people usually have. I'm going to start saying boots, though, just so I'm different. I have this reference to this thing. So.
Yeah.
So he had some notoriety. In fact, he became the lieutenant governor of Tasmania at one point. So this was his fourth expedition. He was already 59 years old. There were a lot of bad omens going on here. And, But he was actually the second choice. The first choice, I forget who it was off the top of my head, had turned it down.
Lucked out turning it down.
Yeah, pretty much, because it got bad pretty fast. And the problem they had was So that it was funny because the person that went the farthest looking for the Northwest Passage was the first expedition, because they had just happened to luck out and the ice didn't, the ice was flowing a different way. So they were able to get to open water. Mm-hmm. And I think they got as far as, they weren't too far from where you'd see on a map where like modern day Alaska is.
Yeah. But,
then they were stuck again because all you could see in front of them was ice. So they had to turn around and come back.
But like they, Franklin wouldn't know that.
No,
like,
Franklin wouldn't know.
They would just, they would see it as an expedition that was like moderately successful.
Yes, they could, and they, you know, they were charting things, but things would change because of the shifting ice.
Mm-hmm.
The islands wouldn't change, of course, they wouldn't. And so what Franklin did, and ironically, Franklin, I don't want to say he made a mistake because he probably didn't realize what he was making a mistake, but it was later found from later researchers that. So Franklin went down the western part of this King William Island. Well, they found that the ice on the west side of the island is worse than on the east side. If he would have went on the east side, it would have broken up in the summer. Whereas on the west side, it didn't. That's why he sat there for like 2 years bound in ice.
Mm.
And I can't even imagine that. Like the silence. I mean, it's a desolate place. I mean, yeah. The Arctic, there's not a lot of game around. Where they were.
Well, we think of what we consider a desert, and we when we hear the word desert, we think, you know, sand, heat, but really it's just like lack of rainwater.
And it seems like they always, and we've talked about this with the Roosevelt expedition to South America, they were always exploring places that were desolate. like you could compare the Arctic to a desert.
Yes.
Because there was not much there. And so... it also gets a lot of, even today it gets talked about probably the more than most expeditions. In fact, no, I don't think most people know that it wasn't until 1903 that someone did go all the way through the passage to the other side.
Huh. So it's kind of, Franklin was chosen for this mm-hmm. passage. What happens next after he's being chosen? Because what's his second choice? And somehow he roped a bunch of people to get there.
Well, there were two ships. One was called the Erebus. And unfortunately, the other one was named the HMS Terror.
Of course.
So, and Francis Crozier was a second in command. And James Fitzjames was the captain of the Erebus. And so it was mostly Navy. Because Navy men would either volunteer or they would just go with. You know, so it was a normal naval crew.
Mm-hmm.
And because there had been expeditions into this Northwest Passage, people were familiar with it.
So they weren't scared. They were just like, oh, yeah, this is going to be standard expedition.
It's amazing to me when I read about, even when I read like Lewis and Clark, there's never any really like complaining, even though they're writing things like in one of the Lewis and Clark things he writes about, you know, tormented by mosquitoes all night, like just one sentence. And I think that's how these guys were, too. They didn't really talk about any hardships they were going to deal with.
It wasn't flowery. You know, when we think of classical literature, they're not right. Writing literature out here. They're mm-hmm. just, here's what happened.
Right.
Our feelings and emotions, where we've got this manly man, we're just, this is what happened. This
so they leave, yeah, so they leave England, 1845, and that's it. They're gone. No one hears from them.
No correspondence.
No nothing. It just like they just fell off the face of the earth.
And well, how, I mean, if that's what happened, when did then people actually start wondering what happened?
About 1848, 49, around there. And actually it was John Franklin's wife, Lady Jane Franklin, who really spearheaded a lot of these search and rescue missions. They were more search, because I think the Admiralty thought something might have gone horribly wrong here. So the Admiralty, they sort of send out this three-prong attack. They send out two search parties by sea. And this is where the story actually, I think, is so, it grabs people's attention. It's all these attempts to find them. It starts in the late 1840s. The Admiralty sends one out, but they don't find anything. And by this point, they're thinking, we can't. So the Admiralty, in 1854, I believe, declared everyone dead or deceased in service is what they would call it. they were no longer going to look for them because they figured they wouldn't have survived any of this. So it was Lady Jane Franklin who at that point commissioned her own search party. And good thing she did. And it was a man named McClintock who took the expedition. And it was in 1859 when they were just on one of the islands. They came across this, what was called a cairn. And a cairn, I think I'm saying it right, are like stones. They're like man-made stone structures that you put things in. So someone recognized this and thought, I wonder if there's anything in there. Well, there was. There was a something called the Victory Point Note. That's what they called it.
Okay.
This was written by, it was actually written in two different times. There was like a pre-printed admiralty form, and someone had written, I think it was the second in command by this time, written, you know, stuck in ice. It was from these ships. So they put it there hoping someone would find it. But the more interesting thing is the second one they find, which was like in April of 1848. They give you the exact date when they abandoned ship. They tell you that Franklin died. Franklin does die. Well, they all did. So now we know Franklin died in 1847. So Franklin's already been dead almost a year.
Does it even say what he died from?
No, they just said he had passed away. And but the interesting thing, though, it also tells us how long they've been stuck in the ice. Because in there's a, and I noticed this when I was looking at the, actually looking at the note, what it said. It said, having been beset since 12th September 1846. Now, this note was written on 25th April 1848. So this is how long they've been stuck in ice. And they tried to get out. You could see that a lot of times when ships were stuck, they would actually try to saw through the ice to get a passage out of there. But, or they would tow them. But what you find is you'd spend all day, 7 hours towing, and you'd be 3 miles behind where you were because the ice with the wind would push the ice back and it would send the ships.
Yep. Because it's a whole ice flow. It's not like it's a single small thing that they're going through. They're going through, like, it's like a whole field of just solid
ice. And in the 1850s, they had found three graves, and they were from members of the expedition. But they tried to exhume the bodies, but they couldn't because of the permafrost. But in 1859, they actually, along with finding this note, they also found a skeleton that still had its, like, clothes on. And from that, they determined that this was a crew member of the Terror. So they knew something bad had happened. And after this note was written by Crozier, who was now in command because Franklin was dead, they were going to set off overland. And then that's it. They're gone. You don't, I mean, and the interesting thing is at this time, they still, and this says it in the note, when they left, they still had 105 people in the party. At this time, only 24, I know it sounds like a lot, but at this time, I don't want to say only, but only 24 people had perished. And so it wasn't until later, and I'm not going to get into how many, you know, how many search missions went out, because really, during the entire 19th century, like every few years, someone went out thinking they were either still going to be alive. But it was a man named John Rea, I believe, John Ray, in 1854, he had actually thought, well, why don't we ask the Inuit if they had encountered them?
That would make sense, because if we, you know, going, let's even 100 years back, if someone disappeared in lands unknown, you'd think they would maybe assume that a native
group. Right, and because the Inuit had these stories about these white men, they called them Kablunas, who had come through, and they would say they fell down dead. Well, they were dying of starvation, probably. That's what would happen. And so he learned, then other expeditions started talking to Inuit because they were finding like bits and pieces of the, you know, these things they would find, these mementos and all these things that were part of the ship, but they just couldn't find anybody. You know, they found a skeleton, so they assumed, but of course people died on these expeditions, but they had never really found anybody else except for those four.
Yeah, that's the thing, because there's usually someone who survived. Someone may have joined a tribe at some point
and
lived, too.
And John Ray, he sort of sent the world agog, because he said that the Inuit had reported that some of the crewmen had engaged in acts of cannibalism, which we know is not uncommon for some expeditions that have run out of food. But this sent, you know, Victorian England on its head, because, you know, our men wouldn't do that. You know, it wasn't until years later that they thought, yeah, they did. So we fast forward. Bones have been found, things have been found, but nothing really concrete. And in 1981, a man named Owen Beatty, who was an anthropologist at one of the universities in Canada, he said, well, let's go explore King William Island. We'll go to the same area that they were on. And they did find a bunch of disarticulated human remains. And all that means is they weren't part of a skeleton. They were just different.
They just, I mean, over time, things are going to move.
Right. And it was here that they found some of the bones had, like, hack marks in them.
And that's how they found the cannibalism, because they would have made some bite-sized pieces.
And later analysis said, yes, there was. And also you could tell some of the bones might have been in a cooking pot because they were, like, smooth, where you would get, like, the marrow out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but one thing his research, so he took a bunch of tissue, or he took these bones and samples, and he sent them off to a lab. And when they came back, they were startled to see that there was a high amount of lead in these bones.
Lead. So the lead, partly, you know, poison, toxic, to say the least. Right. But how would they get lead in there? Because I wouldn't think lead would be found in the Arctic.
It probably came from their ships. And in 1984, I shouldn't say 18, because now we're already up to 1984. And actually, Owen Beatty has written a book called Frozen in Time. And on the cover of the book is the corpse of a man named John Torrington, who was in one of those graves that was found in the 19th century that they couldn't exhume because of the permafrost. Well, now they could. And when they exhumed him, he was almost like mummified. So he was in, I'm not trying to speak ill of the dead, but he was in good shape for them to take a tissue sample.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when they took a tissue sample from Torrington, they found out that he had tuberculosis and he had other maladies. But again, he had lead.
And that could be, if you're saying that's from the ships, but then it's not just the exposure to lead from the ships, it's that they may have consumed some lead that someone else.
And that's where this comes. Then now it's trying to prove, well, was it lead? Because some people didn't think it was. Beatty thought it was because they had, he found a bunch of empty cans, like tin cans that you'd put food in, that were poorly soldered with lead, which means if they were poorly soldered, the lead could have leaked in or leached into the food, and it would have been a slow process. And so, because in the first polar expedition in 1818, they did take tin foods, because to them, tin foods were like the miracle. Now, this is how I'm going to feed everybody. Well, some people said, I don't think so, because I don't think that would provide enough lead to affect your health. But this expedition was also unique in the fact that they had, their ships were fitted with converted railway engines for propulsion. Now, one thing you need with that is you have to create steam. So you need a ton of water. And they had desalinization things on the ship, which none of the other expeditions had this. Mm-hmm. This was the only one. This was unique to them. And so it required almost a ton of water per hour when steaming. So then you have a desalination system, and because everything was made with lead in those days, you would have had large quantities of water with a high level of lead, which the men may have been consuming, drinking it, not eating it. So that was another theory. And it was after the, and so this, after they exhumed some of these bodies and were able to, but then they exhumed this man named Hartnell. So this was John Torrington, who was actually the first person to die in the expedition. And you can tell that these three people or four that they found had like gravestones and everything. That tells me that they were the first ones, and there was really not a lot of haste. So maybe there wasn't a lot of death going on until they had to try to strike out, because there were no other graves found.
They could have, like, they weren't panicking at this point. That was, I mean, when you go on expeditions like these, it's, I don't want to say people would expect some people to die, but Would that be an expectation that someone might die in that, and that people accept that? So I mean, they would.
I mean, one of the amazing things, and we talk about Lewis and Clark, is that one person died in the expedition, and he died of probably appendicitis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, normally you can. I mean, think how many. Even in the Roosevelt one, we talked about. Think how many. How that could have. I mean, that did go wrong, but it could have gone terribly wrong, if they wouldn't have met Indian tribes there who are friendly to them.
Yeah.
If they were seen as a threat, they could have all been wiped out.
And so, in that case, these are their, you know, first deaths. They're fine. They don't know about lead or anything. They're not going to panic yet. But that's when, as it goes further and more people die, that's when things start panicking.
And then one thing that the British Navy did, and they were still doing this even in their Antarctic explorations, they never really learned anything from the Inuit. Like, the Inuit would use dogs to pull things.
That makes sense, yeah.
The British Navy didn't like dogs, so they used men to just, they'd harness them, and they'd pull a bunch of junk they didn't need. So what you're doing is, if you're already suffering from various things because of malnutrition,
mm-hmm.
you're burning up all these calories, hauling this junk that doesn't have any real value. You know, you're bringing all these supplies. You don't have any food, basically. But you're just exacerbating your problem. Plus, they wore woolen clothes. Now, a lot of the Inuit would wear animal skins,
mm-hmm.
and that's because they would stay dry.
Yep.
But if you're wearing woolens and you're pulling all this stuff, you're constantly sweating, those things are getting wet and damp, and so you're constantly just wearing that.
So it's kind of the British didn't learn as well.
And they didn't really ask either.
Which, I mean, that's when you've got groups of people that have been living there for years and years.
Because they would say, oh, you know, this diet they have is terrible. They're eating blubber, they're eating the inside of a deer stomach. Well, it turns out that a lot of the stuff they were eating is why they didn't get scurvy,
mm-hmm.
because it had the nutrients in it. You know, the British would get stuff and cook it, so you're cooking those nutrients out. And so, yeah, and that, you know, even when they had their first when they in 1818, when they took that expedition, they stopped in Greenland. It was the first time they ever had an encounter with northern indigenous people like that. And I was reading a book about this, and the writer kind of said, and they never thought to ask, how did this group of people survive up here? Because there's really nothing around.
They probably looked at the British when they passed by, like, what are these idiots doing? Like, they're just
exactly.
living there, you know, and see the British trying to get through some ice. Like, they're going to die out here.
Right, right. And so, I mean, even, so the lead theory, so the theory from Beatty and some others were that the scurvy, and a lot of them had pneumonia and tuberculosis. And I'm thinking, can you imagine having pneumonia and you're starving to death and you're pulling? I don't even know how.
And you're cold.
Anybody didn't just drop dead then. I mean, that was. But then now a recent chemical reexamination of some of this stuff. And this is still going on now. I mean, this is like 2013. So they've discovered that they lean more toward zinc deficiency because of malnutrition, because it could have had this. It's sufficient enough to suppress your immune system, which leaves you wide open for these other kind of infections and stuff. Because a lot of them have argued that it wasn't quite enough lead. And if you would have looked at their, when they did the isotope, I mean, a lot of it's very scientific-y, so but when they would do the analysis, you would expect a spike in the lead, like right a few months before they would die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another thing you get lead poisoning is you get a mental impairment too. And so if they were hit, that would have been a slow process as well. But I thought the whole thing with the steam engines was funny, because they were the only ones that had that. Yet they were the only ones that met this sort of grisly end. But I think there were other factors working there too.
Yeah. And so I guess I have a few questions here.
Okay.
We found people, but did they find the boats, the ships?
They did. In 2014.
2000, wow.
They found the HMS Erebus, which was... Now, some of the ships, they probably moved from where they originally went down, because eventually the ice would have crushed them and they would have sunk.
Mm-hmm.
And so they found the Erebus south of King William Island. And the HMS Terror was coincidentally found in Terror Bay, not named for the ship. It was just a coincidence that's where it was found.
That's, of course.
Of course it was. And that was 2016. So this is not like 100 years ago they found the ships, and they're still sending, because now it's sort of an archaeological site, that whole area. It's protected by the Canadian government, but you don't see this with other expeditions. This sort of fascination with, they just sort of all disappeared. I mean, but now we know they all died. But I think it was because there was really no traces except for those four, and no one's ever been found. I mean, no one ever found, like, well, this is Franklin.
Oh, wait. So wait, what you're saying here is that they've only found those four bodies
that were in, they found like various that are bones.
Intact. Yeah. Okay.
But these were the only ones that were actually given like a formal, and even the last one was sort of done in haste because they said the poor guy was too small for the coffin. So he's like put in there wrong. And then they like, when they closed the lid, it like smashed his nose. I know it's kind of gruesome stuff, but yeah. And I think that's what even today people still talk about. And I said, John Franklin, not only did he eat his boots, but then, you know, he got all this other stuff. And so I think it was just that whole heyday of exploration in the 19th century, which we've mentioned before on, because there's all kinds of stuff that went on. There was, this is when they started sending expeditions to Africa and places like that. Mm-hmm. And it was John Barrow at the British Admiralty that sort of sent these expeditions out.
Yeah.
To do this. And it was also scientific. I think they were looking for the route, but they were also mapping magnetic data and things of that nature.
Of course, the scientific portion they don't think about is how to survive.
Right.
So,
and it was not until 1903, a man named Roald Amundsen, who was Norwegian, took a boat through the passage. And he basically learned not to go on the west side of King William Island, but to take that water route around it on the east side, and that's how he got through. Mm. And he also learned to wear animal skins, and he also learned to use dogs as sledges, in your sledges.
Wonder where he learned that. Who would have thought?
He learned it from the Inuit, and then, ironically, he was also the first to successfully reach the South Pole in 1911. But he used a lot of that knowledge he learned in the North to use it to go to the South Pole.
These stories are always interesting because, you know, we can, this age of exploration kind of that you're talking about, there's a lot of failure, and those, in this case, everyone just disappearing.
Right.
It seems like, you know, that's what stories are made of. You, right. You have the sense of wonder with the disappearances, which is almost as important as the sense of wonder from discovery.
Right.
Because then you're trying to be like, ooh, what happened? What stories can we think of? What do we scare our kids with at night?
Right. And then I say age of exploration. I know it starts with like Columbus and you go, but it was really in the 19th century you saw a lot of different things going out. But you're right. I mean, and if it hadn't been for them finding that note, I mean, we never would have known how long they were in the ice. We never would have known that Franklin had died. Mm-hmm. And we never would have known that they left the ships to travel overland to try to get to a settlement, which there wasn't many up there.
Yeah, so. That note was like a needle in the haystack note.
It's just weird that they happened to see it. And it wasn't even sticking out. You actually had to open the thing of stones where they had it in. But someone figured there might be something in there, and then they had to take a pickaxe and break it open, and that's how they found this. But if you hadn't found that really led, and really everyone working on this for so many years since it happened, all this analysis and everything, and documentaries, and you've seen, and all these things, and the Canadian government doing some things too. We just wouldn't have known any of those, but it was because of Lady Jane Franklin, who said, okay, I'm going to commission an expedition myself. That's when they started finding things.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was, and like I said, it wasn't until 1903 that someone actually got through it. Now I don't know if people, I think they still use it, but.
I mean, but.
It was one of those like holy grail type. And the search for Franklin, some people described it as sort of a crusade almost, because it became so, it was in the papers. There was even a song, a popular ballad called Lady Franklin's Lament. So it even it reached into popular culture, and I think it kind of stayed there. So, and for nerds like me who like reading about Arctic exploration, you know, I've always been fascinated by this story and all the other ones too, because I'm thinking, it was like just going to not even going to the moon, it's just like going into the unknown. You didn't know what would happen.
Yeah, it's interesting because nowadays, you know, space exploration and ocean exploration. Those are the, yes. Those are the new exploration now. Whether it be Mars, right. The Moon, Marianas Trench, Bermuda Triangle.
The ocean's a good example of, we don't really know much about the ocean way down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's always new things to find.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of new things to find, well, none of what we talk about is new.
No, that's true. It's all happened before.
It's all there. It's just new to our ears. So what are we thinking of cruising through next time?
Next time I'm going to talk about a discovery of something, of the Rosetta Stone.
The Rosetta, that, okay. Because, not the website.
No, not the website, okay. But because of that, that's how we were able to, well, not we, I wasn't actually involved, but that's how we were able to decipher hieroglyphics. Ooh. And it led to a lot of this, what they would call Egyptomania. So
look forward to that. Oh, hey, Scott, did you know that listeners can actually contact us now?
They can. How can they do that?
Yeah, they can just email us at historycruise@mykpl.info.
Great. Also, like and subscribe on any of the platforms you find this podcast.